mother's house. Though it's been many years since I last saw it, I'll always remember that even my first impression was one of fear and wonder. My childhood was soon to be lost, my innocence shattered, and all our dreams destroyed by what we would find within.
The Dallingers were certainly ones to keep it all in the family. Quite literally, in fact. Based on the best-selling series of B.C. Andrews novels, the Dallingers were the twisted sisters and mothers and fathers and brothers and grandmothers and uncles of Flowers in the Attic and its four other books in the series. The Southern Gothic Tales were the twilight of their time. Both series of tawdry novels were penned by young American female authors. Each title was eagerly awaited by adoring fans that helped place them atop the bestsellers list despite critical derision, and both featured tales of forbidden love amongst horror, dark family secrets, and, well, that's about where the similarities end. For Andrews' novels drove down a much darker path than the chaste trappings of Twilight's author Stephanie Meyer. For where Meyer perhaps thought putting fangs on her characters, who were supposed to be vampires, was a bit too edgy, Andrews was not shy of dipping her toes in child abuse, neglect, murder, and incest. Lots and lots of incest. Good evening and welcome to another edition of Natsukashi, where we consider ourselves a rather tight-knit group, but we would like to see our family trees fork. Thank you very much. My name is Rob. I will serve as your host. And tonight, we welcome back our kissing cousin, Miss Shelley Stillo. Hello, Shelley.
Hello there.
Welcome back. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing just wonderfully.
You're not too scarred after this most recent viewing?
Honestly, I'm more scarred now than I was when I was a kid.
We have joining us the film's director, Mr. Jeffrey Bloom. Jeffrey, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for asking me.
I found it.
What do you see, Christopher?
Nothing to see from here. Just some stairs. Is everybody ready to go up?
Not yet. Your mother was given permission to tell you about the attic. But let me remind you again, you must never be seen.
It was released on November 20th, 1987, just in time for those awkward family Thanksgiving gatherings. It landed on number three behind a reissue of Cinderella and The Running Man. Not a reissue of The Running Man, but The Running Man. Went on to turn a profit, $14 million domestically, despite being critically crippled. But I have a feeling that perhaps what happened behind the scenes was much more interesting than what we saw on screen. But first, I want to start with Shelley. Tell us about your first deflowering.
When, if you talk to women my age, and I'm in my 30s, this is the text that, this is the book you brought to the slumber party,
right.
You called your friends, reading passages from it. I actually tried to get a copy to read some of my favorite passages, but I wasn't able to get one in time. But, you know, these erotic passages that everyone would read and kind of giggle over and be shocked by. And I've talked to some women my age as I've prepared for this, and I said, oh, yeah, I'm working on this for Flowers in the Attic. And they're like, oh, my God, Flowers in the Attic, you know. So it was that. It was this kind of salacious book that we picked up on our mother's nightstand. But it was everywhere. It was at the grocery store,
yep.
And it had this, and it still does, have a fairy tale quality to it. And the covers of the books were also really kind of tempting. I remember this kind of two, like a cover where it would have like maybe a window in it on the outside, and then you opened it, and then you'd have like a full cover on the inside, and there were vines, and, you know, it was just very fairy tale-esque. And so there was that element of it, too, which is perfect for, you know, 12, 13-year-old girls. But the reason I said I'm more scarred now is that it was everywhere, and it was our parents, too. Everyone was reading this book, not just, you know, horny 13-year-old girls. Our moms were reading it, you know, our neighbors were reading it. Everyone was reading this book.
I knew Chris would have second thoughts about agreeing with Mother. I found a way to escape, even if it was only to a hot bath and my fantasies. Fantasies of a life filled with dancing, friends, and maybe even romance. Fantasies that might never come true.
Kathy?
Yes?
Can I come in and talk?
J- Jeffrey, I wanted to throw it over to you. You started as a writer in the 70s, most notable, perhaps a comedy caper called 11 Harrow House. And it was also known as the kind of the more generic Anything for Love with Charles Grodin, Candice Bergen, Sir John Gielgud, and also Swashbuckler, which was very well-regarded 1976 pirate film before they became all Vogue and Faye most recently. And that was with Robert Shaw, James Earl Jones, Angelica Houston. Was this your last time in the director's chair for feature films, Flowers in the Attic?
Flowers, no. I did a series after that.
No, for feature films, I mean.
Oh, and features. Yeah, I guess it was. What was it, 87?
Yes.
Yeah, yes, it was.
How were you first introduced to Flowers in the Attic, or how was it introduced to you?
I was working. I had a contract. Most of the time in my career, I was freelancing. And for a brief period of time, a couple of years, I worked for a company called Freeze Entertainment. And it was a great time. I was doing a lot of TV movies and writing and directing them. And that was in a time in the 80s, in the mid-80s, where you could, you know, TV movies could be about something rather than nothing.
Right.
And there were, like, hundreds of TV movies being made every year, so it was terrific, as opposed to, like, 5 or 10 that are being done now. Anyway, we had a very good relationship, and I was successful with them and for them. And they approached me with the idea of doing Flowers in the Attic and said that there had been 4 other writers on it, and they told me who they were. And there were 2 companies. There was Freeze and New World. There was some kind of business relationship between them in terms of financing the film. So they said, you know, if you'd be interested in taking a crack at it, your script is, if we're willing to go ahead with your script, you can direct it. And I said, that'd be great. And I never read any of the other scripts. I didn't care to read any of the other scripts because it was based on a novel, and the only thing that mattered really was the novel.
Starved for both sunlight and food, our faces became pale and our bodies thin. When grandmother stopped feeding us, little Corey became very sick, and every day we watched him become weaker and weaker.
So I read the novel and recognized it right away. To me, it was a fairy tale, and I was aware of the popularity of it and the series of novels after that. And I think, you know, what's a shame is that, you know, you read, if you see the movie, but you haven't read the original script. The original script was a lot different than the movie, and a lot more faithful to it. My feeling has always been about adaptations. I haven't done that many, but the few that I've done, if you're doing an adaptation of a novel that's a successful novel, then the object of the challenge to the screenwriter is to find a way to take whatever it is that the novelist succeeded with and translate it to the screen. So at the least, you'll have to just cut. But to superimpose your own ego over it and to turn it into something entirely different is wasteful and wrong. So I believe in being faithful to the material, and I think I was in the screenplay. And the problem I had, it was a very unhappy experience making this movie. The problems that I had were many, but basically it had to do with too many cooks and too many producers and 2 studios, and everybody had a different idea of what the movie should be, and it was not a happy time.
I'm kind of not surprised because the novel was so popular, and I can imagine, one of my questions was who is the demographic, so I can imagine there was a lot of suits really interested in that question. So on the one hand, I'm not surprised, but on the other, it doesn't, sometimes those kinds of things reflect in the film, and I don't really feel like, I mean, I agree that the film is vast departure from the book, but in terms of, I don't know, you don't see the conflict, you know, it doesn't seem to have hurt the product in the way that maybe that does sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I told them at the beginning, I said that if you, the book is so enormously popular with a certain audience, that if you just do it a faithful rendition of this book, you don't even need a name cast. You just need to say Flowers in the Attic and do a good job on conveying what as much as you possibly can within a couple of hours what the book did. And if you show that at the sneak that after you've shot the movie, you sneak it and you just say Flowers in the Attic, you'll get lines around the block. They're not going to care who's in it. And that's exactly what happened ultimately. We had arguments over cast. I'm not happy with the cast. I wasn't happy with the cast. I really don't want to go into it that much.
Yeah.
It was not a happy experience.
I'll try not to pry too much, but there are some questions that I would like to pose, and one of them would be the Wes Craven rumor. Was that true? Was he involved at some point?
Wes Craven, I think, wrote one of the scripts. I think he was one of the writers. There were four screenplays before I got it, and there was the way the Writers Guild works is that there's a credit arbitration. I ended up with sole credit because it was very simply that when you're basing what you're writing on the novel, then and I had never read any of the other scripts, and so nothing that anybody else had come up with ended up in my script. So I got full credit.
How come you never took us to meet the grandparents before?
I suppose because we were never penniless before. Years and years ago, I did something that angered your grandfather. His punishment was to disinherit me.
Then why are we going there now? I mean, if they won't give us any money.
Because he will. Your grandfather is dying. He's not expected to live much longer. But in that time, I'm going to win back his love. And then, darlings, I'll be the heiress to a fortune beyond your imaginations. And through me, every dream you've ever had will come true.
One of your potential picks was Sharon Stone. Is that true?
It's Sharon Stone came in and read for it. She looked too young.
Okay.
I don't even know how old she was at the time. She was wonderful. I liked her very much, and she had the quality that was really necessary, which was a woman who had a certain warmth about her that you could then play with and turn into something cold. Whereas Victoria Tennant came in and she was. There wasn't a lot of wiggle room.
Right.
Right.
And was she married to Steve Martin at the time? I can't remember.
I think she was, yeah.
Mama, stop! Corinne, control your children. I'll whip them till the blood runs from their backs. Your children are spoiled and indulged and need lessons in obedience. No child that lives under this roof will disobey. Or scream, or show defiance. Do you hear me? Do you? Now, remove your blouse, daughter. And show them how punishment is given in this house.
If you're cruel to my children, I'll take them away tonight.
Take them, Corinne. Take them now. Do you think I care?
How the hell did this get a PG-13 rating? That amazes me. And watching it now as an adult, I'm like, I can't believe some of the things, some of the issues that were touched upon here, and that still managed to squeak by with the PG-13 because it's...
Yeah, you should see some of the things we cut.
Yeah.
Like what?
They cut. Are you aware of the controversy or what happened at the end with the ending?
Yeah, well, I heard that Victoria Tennant had stormed off.
That I didn't do it.
And that it was completely reshot.
Yeah.
And yes.
Yeah. 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 And so ultimately the final cut was out of my hands. The choice of the composer was out of my hands. I wanted David Shore. I had David Shore actually. And but then they came back and they said, we want to reshoot the ending, and we want the kids to kill the mother. Wait a second. This is a series of books. This is not just, something out of the blue. This is a series of books. You have these avid fans. How can you do something like that? And then they said, well, we want to do it. I said, well, I'm not going to do it. And they said, fine, well, we'll get somebody else. So they brought somebody else in who shot, like, a three-minute sequence. They wrote and directed a three-minute sequence for the end. But at the same time, I had to give up all post, control. And so the final edit had nothing to do with me. And they were so concerned about, you know, getting a rating that they cut silly things. I mean, you know, silly shots that were suggestive, but certainly not implicit in any way.
Right.
And that was the fun that we were having with the film, is that it was, we knew within, at the time it was being made, and within the ratings that we wanted, and sort of also with the sense of the book itself. I mean, it was not offensive. The book was not offensive. And so yeah. The movie shouldn't have been offensive. But it was suggestive. And they cut a lot of the suggestive stuff out.
The boys will sleep in one bed, Corinne. The girls in the other.
But I want to sleep with Corey, Mama.
Stop your whimpering, young lady, and listen to me. As long as you're in this house, you will abide by my rules. You will not yell or cry or run about. And when your mother and I leave this room, we will lock this door behind us.
Mother, please, they're children. You can't expect them to.
What I expect, Corinne, is that they will do precisely as I have instructed.
I heard that Louise Fletcher had stayed in character throughout, and I didn't know if that caused any conflict with, you know, especially
with
Louise, the young
okay.
children.
No, Louise was okay. The kids were great. You know, we never had any problem with the kids, and I actually worked later with Christy Swanson, and Jeb Adams became a friend for, you know, we saw him on and off over the years. And the little kids, I don't know whatever happened to the little kids, but I thought they were terrific, the two little ones. The problems were with the suits. The problems were not with the actors.
It seems to be a reoccurring theme we have here on Takashi. Seems like that's
was,
always...
Well, let me tell you, I think at that point I had done like six or seven movies, and I had never had an experience like that. It was understandable that you would never want to... work in Hollywood again and never direct another movie because it was so bad. It was a bad time.
DC Andrews was actually, I mean, she had a very, very minor role in there as a window washing maid.
Yeah.
Was she aware of these changes and did she have any say at that point?
No, the author never has any say. But there weren't that many changes.
I mean, toward the ending.
The screenplay was really very faithful to the book. You know, you can't do a 400-page book as a movie.
No.
You have to cut. But we didn't change. We did not change. It was very faithful to the book. And then New World wanted to make a monster movie. You know, and then it became something different. Whether she was aware of what was changing after the original draft of the script, I don't know.
Yeah,
you know, that's where my question about demographics comes in, is that I experienced it in some regard as a horror movie because I was already kind of a horror fan, and so I was seeking out those kinds of films, and it didn't appeal to that demographic generally. There were so many other people reading that book who, you know, it was
because
a romance novel.
That's because I was fighting them all the time. It was a constant fight, which is why it was an unhappy experience.
Yeah, you know? Because it just seems strange that just how you would even categorize it, because it does have those horror elements because of abuse, but at the same time, like you said, it's a fairy tale. I think that's what it is first and foremost, and then also a romance.
Yeah.
You know? So I was trying to figure out who the demographic even could have been, and it sounds like it was really never clear to anyone.
The demographic was aimed at the same audience that I thought was reading the book. The way I interpreted it is that the people that were reading the book and made the book successful were young girls and women up to, I don't know, whatever age. I never thought it was a book that was read by boys, and I mean, I just assumed that after reading it. It seemed like a romance. It seemed like a fairy tale. It did not seem like something that many young men or boys would be reading. So that was my target audience when I wrote the screenplay, and what I intended to make as a film. Yeah, I think I knew what it was, and I wanted to do it, and I think I could have done it under different circumstances.
Because it was also, in a strange way, a strong female heroine. Because I am... In a sort of strange way, it had a strong female heroine in it.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was really, because the brother took control in a lot of the places, but she seemed to have a much sharper sense of what was really going on
Definitely.
Than he did.
Definitely.
So I think that's another reason it appealed to that audience, not just the themes, but her, but that character.
Yeah, I agree.
As the weeks became months, our memories of our real home began to fade, but we clung to our dreams. Chris wanted to go to medical school someday, and I wanted to be a dancer. We tried to act like a family. It was the only way we could survive.
Michelle, you sat down and watched this again most recently, your most recent viewing. Tell us about it.
Thought you're braver than I am.
Well, like I said, the thing that, well, it's interesting because when I was a kid, I really didn't care what was going on between the adults in either the film or the book. You know, so I was most interested in the relationship between the brother and sister, which, you know, as you said, it had some suggestiveness to it. And I had forgotten completely the suggestiveness in the relationships among the adults, you know, that the mother, you know, there had married the uncle, and that there was this scene with the whipping in front of her own father, and all that was a surprise because I just hadn't remembered it because I wasn't interested. I was interested in the kids because of my age at the time, which I guess is what made this book so powerful. It had one set of characters for our parents and the one set of characters for us. So then we all loved reading it, which is what Twilight doesn't have.
Right.
It just has the teenagers. So that was one thing I noticed, and that was, on the one hand, it was kind of, that's what kind of disturbed me about it. I thought, gosh, why was my mother so into this movie? It, like, but on the other hand, it's so, all of that darkness is there in traditional fairy tales, in the romances from, you know, the 18th and 19th century. It's just in, you know, the Cold War era that we've taken all of that out of those stories. You know, but historically it was all just that way. You know, it was Catherine and Heathcliff, you know, are just as dark as anything in Flowers in the Attic. So on the one hand, I was thinking, gosh, it's strange that my parents were into this movie. But on the other hand, it's been like that for a long time.
Do you know why your mother has come home?
Yes, to win back her father's love, so he'll make her part of his will again.
And why was she stricken from that will? Did she tell you that?
I have to go to the bathroom.
Be silent. Learn control. And never, never speak unless I ask you a question.
But he's just a little boy.
What did I just say? Your mother has come home after 17 years to repent for her sins and for her crimes, not only against your grandfather and me, but against God. Your mother's marriage was unholy, a sacrilege, an abomination in the eyes of the Lord. She did not fall from grace. She leapt into the arms of a man whose veins pulsed with the same blood as hers. Not a stranger, but her own uncle. And you, the children, are the devil's spawn, evil from the moment of conception.
I'm getting my mother!
What I'm interested from you, Jeffrey, is, okay, this film wrapped. It was completed. The second you walked off the set, had you washed your hands of everything? Were you done with it at that point?
I washed my hands of everything other than disappointment.
Right.
It was. Mm-hmm. I felt. Here's what I felt. The disappointment I felt was to the audience, to the fans. And over the years, every once in a while, if I'm really feeling either, you know, brave or, like, you know, self-flagellation, I'll go on, Google, you know, something about Flowers in the Attic, and I'll read a couple of comments, and usually they're really nasty, and I feel bad because it was not my intention, and it's disappointing. I mean, when you as an author create a work that is so popular and then it becomes a film that is unfaithful to it, and or doesn't live up to the goodness or the greatness that you created in your book, it's really a disappointment. And even though I know that movies and books are different things, This movie could have been better. It could have been better as I made it. It could have been better if they would have, you know, left me alone. And it's just a shame. You know, it really is a shame.
One thing that I noticed, the positive thing, and I don't know if this was intentional at the time or if, since it sounds like the editing was kind of out of your hands, but the opening shot reminded me a lot of Rebecca and The Haunting, you know, that it opens with the house and kind of an introduction to the house before you get any of the horrors.
Which house? Which move? Which house?
The house that the children were in. You know, the very first scene of this movie, the very first shot, it's is of one of the stone figures, I think, on the outside of the house.
Yeah, I mean, like the title sequence, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and Christy Swanson's got a voiceover saying, you know, I remember the first time I saw it, and it filled me with terror before I even knew what was going to happen
mother,
to me.
You putting the makeup on, all that kind of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but even before that, it was just some exterior shots of the house itself.
The house. Yeah. Yeah.
And it reminded me of Rebecca and The Haunting, those movies that do that, where, you know, that's what you get before you get anything else. So I don't know if that was you or if that was
That was an interesting time. We spent me and one of the producers, Tom Freeze, spent weeks all over the country looking for a location. And we found this place, ultimately, outside of Massachusetts, outside of Boston. And we were just so knocked out, or I was so incredibly knocked out by the exterior views, you know, and the green that went down to the water, and the look of the house from there, from the outside. It wasn't the perfect house, but it had, you know, it was the best house that we found at that point. I think the best house would have been smaller and a little bit more realistic than some giant mansion, but we were looking at that point for I don't know how long, and we found this place, and it was good. It was good.
I really love the location because, on the one hand, it reminded me of those gothic films where you get that sense of the space, but then it also again reminds me of the fairy tales, you know, being trapped in the tower of a castle.
Everything about it was great, except if we would have found exactly that same place and exactly that same kind of location and those wonderful exteriors, but the whole thing would have been like half the size, it would have been better. It was just a little bit too big. But anyway, that's neither here.
Was it filmed on location or just the exterior shots?
Excuse me?
Was it filmed on location or was just the
almost
exterior
all
shots?
Of it. The roof sequence, that whole sequence of the roof was shot, was built in L.A., but everything else, and the attic was built in L.A., but all the interiors of the house and the exteriors were all shot in Boston.
Because that was something that really impressed me watching it this time, was the location, both the exterior and the interior.
What have we done to be called sinners? Do you expect us to live in one room week after week and not see each other? You put us here. You locked us in. You want to catch us doing something you can call evil. Look at you in your black dress, and your fancy jewels, and your pinched face. We're not afraid of you. We laugh at you. Do you hear that? We laugh. Get out! Out! Out!
My only other question is, what was your initial reaction when you read the novel? You know, how did you feel about before, you know, everything happened with the studio and everything? Because it is it's a provocative book.
I saw it as a challenge. I knew nothing about it prior to them handing it to me and handing me the book and saying, you know, read this and see if you're interested. I knew nothing about it. And so I read the book, and then I started, you know, then I did a little bit of research about D.C. Andrews and the other books and realized that it was a, you know, a bit of a cult. And but I was challenged by it right away because of I saw it as a fairy tale, and I thought, what a wonderful, you know, a gothic fairy tale. What a great opportunity to be able to do something that would be, you know, not only visually interesting and you know, emotionally appealing to me, but also it was a chance to do something that had a huge fan base. It was a bestseller. Mm-hmm. And you don't often get that opportunity. And that's the disappointment. That's where the disappointment comes, is that when you're given this responsibility or given this opportunity to be able to do a, you know, a film version of a bestseller, then it should be better.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be more faithful to the material. And it should not be something that the fans are disappointed by. It was just, there were so many things that went wrong. There's a classic example of Hollywood, you know, making lots of mistakes.
Yeah.
So I take it then, judging from this conversation, that the proposed rumored remake from, well,
I don't know anything about that. I've heard about it. I don't know anything about it. I don't follow it.
Well, it was MGM, so who knows what state it's in now, because MGM is certainly not in the best financial ways.
Is there still an audience for Flowers in the Attic? Is the question.
I mean, DC Andrews, certainly the name itself was certainly profitable for the family, the estate afterward, because she...
Yeah, well, after she's dead, 100 books have come out. You know, she keeps writing.
Yeah, yeah. She's like the Tupac of literature. She continues to produce...
No, every 3 months I'd see another DC Andrews book. I'd say, wait a minute, she's dead.
So I take it you probably will not be setting foot on set of the remake.
But the point is well taken, that there's obviously, if they keep producing these books, there obviously is a fan base and people are buying them. And doing a remake of Flowers, if they did it right, that's all. I mean, you know, I could do it again. If they give me a chance to do it the right way, but they could also blow it again.
And what bothers me about it is just one of the things we were talking about is that you don't get a lot of anything, music, films, books, television shows that have a cross-generational appeal anymore. Yeah. And so I don't know if they would just eliminate, you know, mm-hmm. the parents' roles entirely.
That's right.
That's kind of disturbing.
To think about. Yeah, it is disturbing.
It is time to pack this episode back into the trunk, but before doing so, I want to thank Shelley Sillow again for unearthing the things found in her attic and coming back down and revisiting them with us, and also the film's screenwriter and director, Jeffrey Bloom, who you can find on jeffreybloomphotography.com. Are there any other sites that you would like to...
No, if you go to jeffreybloomphotography.com, you'll find my Smug Mug site.
Both of you, thank you very much for taking your time out of your schedule this evening and revisiting Flowers in the Attic. I'm sorry. I hope it wasn't too painful for you, Jeffrey. But we certainly learned a lot.
It was, actually.
A lot of thorns in these flowers, huh?